Hello and welcome back to another near silent episode of The Damage Report. Very glad to have you here because it's gonna be a pretty big day. Not only are we gonna be joined once again by Jordan Yule, who's gonna help me break down some of the big news of the day, including some updates on Mike Bloomberg and his appearance on a certain debate stage a little bit later on this week, which we will of course be covering live here on TYT. We've also got some new attacks against Bernie Sanders. We're gonna be joined by a candidate. And we're gonna close out the show with a special look at a political event from the past couple of days that I thought was pretty important. So I'm gonna give my thoughts on that. So obviously, lots to get to. Why don't we launch right into it? With Mike Bloomberg, we've been talking a lot about him in recent weeks, his record as mayor of New York, some of his past statements, which have been absolutely abhorrent. In terms of his policies, though, we haven't really had much to say because he hasn't really had much to say about it. But maybe that's beginning to change with new details coming out of what he plans to do as president in terms of higher education. So the full plan is now available. It was just released this morning. But in anticipation of that, Ryan Grimm and Ida Chavez of The Intercept got a leaked copy of it. And so they were able to do a write-up of it and a comparison between what Bloomberg plans to do and some of the other main Democratic candidates. And one thing I want to point out about that that I think is awesome is that the plan was leaked apparently by multiple Bloomberg employees. It wasn't like one person got a copy of it. It was like a bunch of people were just rushing to give this to people. And so what's interesting about that is that Bloomberg is hiring up pretty much everyone, giving like good salaries and all that. That does not mean that everyone who is going to be taking his money wants him to win. And there's probably gonna be a lot of leaks coming out in the future. But anyway, let's start on his education plan. I wanna give you an idea of who he actually would be as president. So we're gonna start off with one thing that I think is pretty symbolic of his overall plan. So his plan commits to tripling direct federal Title III funding to historically black colleges and universities, Hispanic serving institutions, and other minority serving institutions. As a comparison, that increase amounts to just $7.5 billion over 10 years. Over that same period, other candidates are proposing more in funding. Joe Biden is proposing $70 billion. Bernie Sanders is proposing $50 billion. About 6 months ago, I think it was, Elizabeth Warren put out her plan, which had quite a bit more money than Mike Bloomberg. And this is a trend that you're gonna notice throughout all of this. It's like in some cases, it's better than the status quo, but almost always worse than what's on offer, not just from like the radical Dem progressives, but even like Klobuchar and Buttigieg and candidates like that. So hardly the sorts of plans that are going to come in at this late date in the primary and really like set fire to the Democratic base. Now here is where it actually sometimes is worse. And by worse, I don't just mean worse than like Sanders or Warren. I don't just mean worse than Biden. I don't just mean like that. I mean, in some cases, his plan is worse than what we have right now. So his plan would slash the benefits borrowers receive under an income-driven student loan repayment program, capping the amount that could be forgiven after 20 years at $57,000 for people in income-driven repayment plans. Currently, there is no cap. So look, I'm not gonna lie to you, there are good things in this plan. And we're gonna get to some of those points in just a second. But I want you to understand, there are parts of this plan that is worse than what Donald Trump is proposing. That is more punitive for low income student debt holders than what we have under a Republican president, than what we have under Betsy DeVos. And we're looking to potentially this guy being the Dem nominee, replacing these horrible people with their anti-education agenda, and then making things harder for people burdened by a large amount of debt. Anyway, so look, though his plan also reduces the monthly repayment amount, and like I said, we're gonna get the good and we're gonna get the bad, down from the current 10%, it's still significantly less generous than current law to a significant portion of the estimated 8 million borrowers who rely on income-based repayment plans to pay off their student loans. And so look, in some ways it's good, in some ways it's bad, but that is not supposed to be what's on offer as a replacement for Donald Trump. And it's just bizarre that that's the direction that he's choosing to go in. Not if you know who he is, but if you're just sort of like learning about him now because of Facebook ads, if you ever have the details of his plan spelled out to you, it's gonna be a weird process of understanding who this guy actually is and what he plans to do. For certain people, hypothetically, yes, maybe capping it in the end could result in less payments. but that's worse than under certain plans right now what you could end up paying. Anyway, here's where I think the difference is far more stark between him and some of the other candidates, in particular Bernie Sanders. So when it comes to student debt cancellations, so people who've accrued huge amounts of debt, it's literally trillions of dollars. Sanders' universal student debt cancellation plan goes the furthest on the issue, vowing to cancel every last dollar of student debt. Okay, so if you care about the crushing effect of student loan debt on literally millions of students, the effect it has on their ability to really freely choose what job they're gonna pursue, whether they're gonna start a business, buy a home, buy a car, participate in the economy, all of that stuff, then this is probably the direction you want to go in. Now, he's not the only one who has a plan. Warren has a means-tested plan. It would offer no debt forgiveness for those making more than $250,000 a year and would cap the amount forgiven at $50,000 per person regardless of income. Warren has pledged to implement a plan by executive action, which wouldn't require congressional approval. So both of them do cancel debt, although with Warren, there's a limit on how much. And if you make a certain amount, that's going to rule out the forgiveness too. Bloomberg has no interest in any of this. He's not having a conversation about this sort of stuff. So if you want like sort of a bold response to this huge amount of debt that is definitely hindering the American economy, then don't go to Bloomberg. And what's interesting is in terms of access to college and trying to make it debt-free in the future. So there's the people who already have the debt now, and then there's those who will be burdened in the future. He wants to make 2-year public college tuition free for all and debt-free for the lowest income students. So 2-year public college. If you are the lowest income, they will make it debt-free. Doesn't mean that you're not gonna pay anything, but it gets close to that. For other people, it's tuition free for all. So even in the case of 2-year public colleges, this is like less than what Obama was pushing for near the end. You'd still be paying quite a bit. You would still leave with student loan debt. In the case of 4-year public colleges, they'd be tuition and debt free again for the lowest income and affordable for all, including doubling Pell grants. Look, I mean, maybe me in like 2001, 2002, when I was getting Pell Grants, the idea that we would double them would be pretty exciting. But it's 2020, and that is weak sauce. And look, I'm glad that in this case too, those who are at the lowest sort of rung of the economic ladder are going to get the most benefit. That's great. But that's like that's already incorporated into the bolder plans. And then you wouldn't also have people who are making a little bit more, perhaps have a little bit more to contribute, that also then would be able to leave without accruing massive amounts of student loan debt. And that's 4-year public college. Like it's like Bloomberg is desperately, he's doing his best to try to catch up to 5 or 6 years ago what some of the relatively moderate proposals were to deal with the issues in higher education. And this is like the most substantive plan of his that I've seen so far. Maybe we'll get more. Although if I were Mike Bloomberg, I probably would do as little as possible to put out my detailed plans because they're not gonna stand up to critique. But this is what we have so far. If you are a worker for the Bloomberg camp, please continue leaking these. We would love to take a look. If you, like many Americans, are currently crushed under $10, $20, $50, $100,000 in student loan debt, this might not be the direction that you wanna go in. So with that, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, Jordan Ewell is gonna join us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've been wondering in advance of tomorrow's debate, would Mike Bloomberg actually meet the new updated DNC requirements? And in fact, he has, with just one day to go. Bloomberg met the DNC's committee as a mandated polling threshold, with an NPR survey finding him at 19% nationally. The result is Bloomberg's fourth poll at or above 10% nationally. Now, that still puts him in second place to Bernie Sanders, who's up at 31% with a nice big lead. But Bloomberg now at 19%, and he will be on the debate stage. And joining now to discuss this and other big news of the day, progressive activist Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So how excited are you? He's spent hundreds of millions of dollars, we'll break it down in a minute, and he is still creeping up, almost to 20% there.
Yeah, Bloomberg's entire campaign is just a mockery of an already broken system. It's a completely cynical ploy. He's just buying name recognition. He's buying support. I mean, effectively, a lot of what he's doing is bribing people, bribing officials, and also bribed his way onto the debate stage by, you know, donating the maximum amount to the DNC, and suddenly they changed their rules. And these were rules that knocked Cory Booker off the stage, knocked Julian Castro off the stage. So if for the Democratic Party to, you know, keep a rigid set of rules that impacted candidates of color while simultaneously taking money from and changing the rules for a former New York mayor that ran an explicitly racist police system, really just shows how committed to ideas of intersectionality and you know, civil rights and equity the DNC actually is.
Look, I'm totally with you, and we're definitely going to be breaking down quite a bit about Bloomberg today. But I did want to get your brief response to the other standout. I would say perhaps even more important in this most recent poll that we were discussing is Bernie Sanders up at 31%, a nice big lead for the senator.
Right. I mean, Bernie is showing that he can galvanize support. He's got, if you've seen videos or pictures of his rallies over the past couple of days, he is packing thousands, tens of thousands of people into these arenas. He's having electric rallies. He's got concerts at some of them. He's just, you know, he's got the support. And when we need a robust grassroots movement that can, and a candidate that can drive turnout and drive enthusiasm to beat Trump, all signs point to Sanders as that guy. You can't astroturf support and turn it into a sustainable movement because just the energy just isn't there.
I agree. You probably can't turn it into a sustainable movement, but with enough money, maybe you can do something. So let's talk about that money on Bloomberg's behalf. So Li Feng tweeted today, they've now disclosed $400 million in broadcast radio and cable ads, $42 million on Facebook ads alone, $36 million on Google ads. God knows how much on staff research and polling, obviously in terms of staff. All of these headlines are saying they're hiring up so much staff across the country that other campaigns can't find people to work for them with experience. And of course, Li Feng is concluding there that his initial promise to hit $1 billion, like he's gonna blow right past that. We're in February at this point, and he's spent over a half a billion dollars already.
Right, and his strategy is also spending this money and not going away even if he gets mathematically eliminated, which is extremely problematic. He's just going to be a thorn in the side if it's Sanders. He is committing to people. I heard last night from a friend, someone was offered $95,000 for a 6-month contract with Michael Bloomberg. That is flabbergasting in the world of Democratic politics. This is kind of a low-level position too. He is just throwing piles of cash at people. And what it's doing is making people who otherwise would oppose everything he has done and stands for turn a blind eye to it. Yeah. And what this does is on a national level creates an environment where everyone is ignoring the elephant in the room because of money being thrown at them. And that leads to a flawed candidate going into the general if he is the nominee.
I mean, to me, when I see those numbers, I just, like, I get sick, like deep in my stomach, the idea that something like this could happen and that we don't all unified have the response of this is gross. Like, what country do you think we are? Like, you clearly think that you can buy this thing. And now I'm seeing tweets from people saying that, like, there are two sides. One is that when you point out that he's trying to buy the election, how dare you try to divide us based on class? And even I'm seeing the beginnings. Maybe it won't go any farther than this, but the claim that he's trying to buy the election is being portrayed as an anti-Semitic attack by Bernie Sanders supporters. What do you think about that?
I mean, just both absolutely bad faith deflections there. You have to call it out for what it is. Like, there was no way around it. And you alluded to it. We need to see Democratic and progressive organizations unify against this whole process, because this isn't just a one-off thing. This is going to be the model for which other billionaires replicate going forward. There is nothing stopping Jeff Bezos from doing the exact same thing in 4 years, or Mark Zuckerberg from doing the exact same thing in 4 years. I don't know about you, and I can assume where your heart is. I don't think you want that system going forward. I don't think your viewers want that system going forward. I sure don't. I don't want a system where billionaires can just buy their way into the presidency. So we need to see progressive and democratic nonprofits and organizations unite in opposition to what Bloomberg is doing, and send a loud and clear statement to anyone who thinks they can replicate this. We will not stand for it. We will not support you. We will shut this down.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of where my heart is at, it frustrates me to no end that to run for a state house seat, you need to raise tens of thousands of dollars. Like, the idea that potentially we need, like, someone who can raise half a billion is just absolutely insane. And, like, when you talk about numbers like this in comparison to the other candidates, I was talking with Nando Vila yesterday, and I said what it feels to me like is, as a fan of sci-fi, it's like sometimes I will try to think about, like, distances in space, and, like, you think that you can do it, but you can't actually do it because our brains were developed on the savanna and they're intended for, like, sightline distance. Like, numbers become so big that they just become nonsensical. This is, yeah, I think, maybe a little bit convenient, and because to anyone this is going to seem insane if it's covered seriously, but it's just not sustainable. Like, for not just regular people to have a chance at a political office if this is a system we're gonna have, but even regular wealthy people to have a chance.
Right, and this is just for how much money he's spending. Think about all the good he could do if he spread that around in other ways. If he invested that same amount of money in state and local races around the country, if he invested in infrastructure, like in Flint, for example,
yeah,
if he invested in new technologies or new or nonprofits or ongoing efforts to address climate change, like, these are all things that can make a huge impact. But he's doing this for himself, and it's in, like you mentioned earlier, this is leaving state and local races with an insufficient staffing level.
Yeah.
So you're seeing other races and other candidates negatively impacted by the Bloomberg candidacy, and this is purely self-serving. So this isn't really about beating Trump or ushering in a new era of the Democratic Party or Democratic control, because there is a scenario where he wins, but everyone else is hindered and loses. So this is all about him, and it's all about his ego. This should be widely condemned.
Okay, so I want to turn to another aspect of this. As we alluded to, Mike Bloomberg has now qualified for the debate that's going to happen tomorrow in Nevada. So I want to talk about strategy for how the candidates should address it. But before we get to that, obviously we've pointed out that the rules appear to have been changed specifically to allow him to make the debate stage, which bothers us on a fundamental level. But this will be the first time that he will be directly accountable to literally anyone in this race. Is there sort of a significant silver lining that he's going to be standing on the stage with, for instance, Bernie Sanders? And that right now, with all of the news of his past statements, his positions, his stuff about stop and frisk, that he won't be able to skate by another 2 weeks or a month before having to actually answer to any voters?
You know, we'll see. We'll see how the moderators, and we'll see how other candidates treat him. I would hope that they go at him with bare knuckles, because he's got a terrible track record. He's got an explicitly racist past. He's sexually harassed dozens of women, and similar to Trump, forced them into silence through NDAs. All around, objectively terrible person. And if I was a Democratic candidate, I would be ashamed that I'm sharing the stage with this guy. So I would hope that they go after him. One thing I'm worried about is because of Sanders' surge, you might see people try to take swipes at him or even equate this phony Bernie bro narrative to try to hinder Sanders. We'll see also with the moderators how delicately they handle him, because they are relying on him now for advertising revenue.
Yeah.
So we'll see. This is a conflict of interest now on the corporate media side.
I mean, it certainly is. And so I want to get your predictions in a couple different areas. But first with the moderators, it seems like, I mean, with all of the statements of his that have been making the rounds over the past week, especially the sexual harassment cases, the kill it comment, the stop and frisk comments, like, there's certainly a financial conflict of interest there. Do you think that the moderators can afford to not ask those questions for how obviously biased that's going to look when this is our first chance to hear directly from him, not in an ad that he has produced? Do you think that they could actually not ask about those substantive concerns?
If they do ignore, that is going to be a scandal in itself. They need to address it. They have to. This is a candidate who's running. But my fear is now the downside. If by doing that, you're going to give Bloomberg a overinflated talking time or talking amount, whatever you want to call it. Like, so he's going to get a lot of screen time as a result of this. And I'm sure he's got responses for all of it and ways to pivot and move on to other subjects. But he's now going to get a ton of screen time because he's just a deeply flawed person. So I hope they don't ignore it. They shouldn't. Because this is a terrible guy, but you know, again, the downside is he gets more talking time as a result.
Now, as we've I think talked about in the past, this is to some extent for Bernie Sanders almost perfect that he's been railing against this sort of influence over politics, and now the guy's going to be standing there. So, if you were advising Bernie Sanders today in advance of the debate tomorrow, what should his strategy be?
Oh man, Bernie Sanders needs to just go for the jugular. This is it. This is the problem. This is the problem in American politics. You have a billionaire just throwing tons of cash at politicians, elected officials around the country to buy their support, to artificially buy name recognition through huge ad buys around the country by paying like the worst, most reprehensible people on Instagram to promote you there without any oversight or regulation. Come on, this is a grotesque end result of the American political experiment, and it's gone completely unaddressed because everyone is beholden to corporate money. So Sanders has just, you know, this is like setting him up with T-ball, like a T-ball swing. Like this is his bread and butter. So we should see a strong night from Sanders on that front.
I don't know. I'm worried now about your analogy because I've seen him play basketball, but on baseball, I'm not sure that I've really seen much. So we're gonna have to see how he does. Okay, stick around for this next break. We're gonna have more Jordan after this. I want to briefly apologize to our audience because in our coverage over the last few weeks of the Democratic primary, we've been really distracted by Mike Bloomberg's horrific track record as mayor of New York and his horrific statements. When we should have been covering things that some random person on Twitter who might not even be an actual human was saying that's mean about Biden or something. That's according to most of the people in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders supporters talking smack online. That's the big issue. And we're gonna go through some of the responses from Dem primary candidates about this issue. But we're joined once again by Jordan Ewell, progressive activist. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Have you seen this? Have you seen what these people are saying on Twitter, Jordan?
Oh, John, of course I have. I haven't slept in weeks. I'm deeply alarmed about the way millionaires and billionaires are being treated on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Talk to my therapist weekly about it. I'm just deeply upset. I'm so thankful we're talking about this now.
Yeah. And look, I understand if anybody's making death threats or anything, obviously that's totally unacceptable and also right. Totally uncontrollable by another person who doesn't control them or the sock puppet network of bots that's being operated. It's ridiculous. But anyway, let's go through some of what the Democratic primary contenders are saying. Joe Biden was quoted as saying, "You know me well enough to know that if any of my supporters did that, i.e. attacked the Nevada Culinary Union after they didn't endorse Bernie Sanders, I'd disown them, flat disown them. The stuff that was said online, the way they threatened these two women who are leaders in that culinary union, it is outrageous." So after they put out this statement about the candidates saying that Bernie would cancel culinary healthcare if he got Medicare for All passed, which is obviously nonsense, some people that are not employees for Bernie Sanders' campaign, they're not surrogates, they're not anything, tweeted mean things, including apparently doxing individuals. And so Joe Biden is now leaping on this as an inroads to attack Bernie Sanders.
Well, yeah, I mean, these types of stories, these Bernie bro stories, and online supporter harassment, it's ultimately just because they have nothing else to hit Sanders with. They tried the few weeks of Oppo where it was like Bernie Sanders said something weird that didn't age well, but he said it in 1972. Is this disqualifying? It just shows the desperation that they have with him because they can't really attack him on substance because his voting record is pretty great. He hasn't really flip-flopped in 30 years. So they have to resort to these types of things, like attacking alleged supporters. So for Joe Biden, my question is, your supporters are Wall Street executives who profited while everyone else in the country struggled during the 2008 financial collapse. Are you going to condemn him or condemn them? Are you going to tell your supporters to stop engaging in predatory loans, to stop profiting off of people's, misfortune in the financial industry? Like, or if someone else takes a loss and your supporters gain, are you going to condemn them? So I think these tactics are disingenuous because obviously Sanders has no control over what a complete stranger posts online. They have nothing else really to hit Sanders with. So we see this kind of glomming on to this narrative because they think it sticks.
And it's not just coming from Biden. Mike Bloomberg had released this ad, literally screenshotting random people on Twitter who were apparently abusive. Some of them, the tweets had hashtag Yang Gang in them, which seems like a tip off that they're not Bernie Sanders supporters. They might be supportive of another candidate. I don't know who, but maybe one. Since then, Bernie has been very critical of Mike Bloomberg. And so Mike Bloomberg's campaign manager released a statement titled "Bernie's New Bro, Donald Trump." Because Donald Trump has criticized Bloomberg and Bernie has criticized Bloomberg. So Bernie and Donald Trump are now bros. What do you think?
The Bloomberg campaign doing this is just so bizarre. The video itself, I do want to say, I think sets a dangerous precedent because I don't think presidential campaigns should be singling out private people like that, no matter what they say online. Like, you can think it's bad, but putting that type of stuff in a nationally syndicated, nationally broadcast advertisement is deeply alarming, and we really should point that out. Like, this, the Bernie bro narrative aside, you really shouldn't be singling out private supporters or private people if you are running a national campaign. Super alarming.
Yeah, and so in response to that, I just want to briefly say, because I enjoyed this, Bernie Sanders tweeted no caption, just a photo of Mike Bloomberg with Donald Trump. And there have been many going around because they did actually hang out at parties and go golfing together and all of that stuff. So far as I know, Bernie Sanders has never had a fun little day with Donald Trump. But anyway, I do want to transition to one other part of this. So Elizabeth Warren was asked recently about Bernie Sanders supporters' comments online. And here's how she responded to those concerns.
So when Culinary 226 did come out and criticize Bernie Sanders for Medicare for All, his supporters really attacked them. Do you feel, and you're someone who's actually come under that attack before, back in Iowa, back in January, do you feel like he's done enough to condemn the culture online that stems from his movement?
I've said before that we are all responsible for what our supporters do. And I think Bernie has a lot of questions to answer here. And I am particularly worried about what happened to the attacks on members of the Culinary Union, particularly on the women in leadership. The whole notion of publishing their personal addresses, their phone numbers, and then making very aggressive threats against their own safety and the safety of their families, that is not how we build an inclusive Democratic Party, and it is not how we build Donald Trump. We do not build on a foundation of hate.
Okay, so I can't say for sure, but it certainly sounds like she was implying at the end that Bernie Sanders is building on a foundation of hate. And at the very least, she agrees with Bloomberg and Biden that if these people online who have never met Bernie Sanders, he has no affiliation with them, if they say something bad, that it is Bernie Sanders who should answer for that. That's what Elizabeth Warren just said.
Yeah, that's a dangerous precedent. And just to show how ludicrous it is, before I joined you, I was on Twitter and I saw Glenn Greenwald sharing some of the messages and tweets that he's received from Elizabeth Warren supporters when he was facing the threat of imprisonment in Brazil at the hands of a fascist dictator. There were Elizabeth Warren supporters who didn't like Glenn's stance on the Russia investigation, saying they hope he rots in jail. So by Elizabeth Warren's own standards, she is now on the hook for that. So she needs to come out and condemn that. And of course, that is a ludicrous proposition. And that's what Glenn was trying to get to, because it's really not on her to point that out, just like it's not on Bernie Sanders to point out Leon Thotsky 42069 with 15 followers tweeting at the Culinary Union. It's a ludicrous proposition, but for instances like, you know, Warren's campaign is struggling. And it's kind of sad that now she's resorting to trying to kneecap Sanders just to try to stay afloat. So we're seeing desperation because they don't really have anything to hit them on substance. So they're trying this kind of like wacky Bernie bro conspiracies and this whole narrative.
And I want to say, like, I guess as like the starkest comparison, this is something that I mentioned on the main show yesterday. I couldn't tell you how many tweets I've received, you've probably received, from like red hat wearing MAGA heads over the past few years that are just vicious. I've muted all of them, I don't see as many anymore, but they're certainly out there. I don't think in the literally hundreds of hours I've spent criticizing Donald Trump over the past 3 years, I don't think I've ever asked for him to answer for what his people, like, and he deliberately tries to get them to do this stuff to stoke the anger. And I still don't think that he's responsible for it. I think he's responsible for what he tweets or retweets, and it's usually abhorrent. I would never expect even him to be able to control his own cult members, let alone Bernie Sanders to control maybe some of his supporters, maybe convenient accounts that have been set up by supporters of other candidates that want to make Bernie Sanders look bad.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping anybody from creating fake accounts and just going on and harassing people, pretending to be a supporter of somebody else. And one thing I do want to point out is this: we saw this Bernie bro narrative in 2016. As reporters have pointed out, a lot of those story pitches came from the Hillary Clinton campaign. But also in 2008, we saw the exact same thing tried against Obama. The alleged Obama bros, if you remember that story from Salon in 2008, it's the same narrative where they're trying to just paint the supporters of populist progressive candidates as, you know, misogynistic, harassing online bros. Yeah. And, you know, in this instance, it completely erases the diverse coalition of Bernie Sanders supporters. It is a whitewashing of a diverse supporter base.
You know what? Just to get out ahead of the curve, I'm gonna have a t-shirt made that says "Future Ocasio Bro," because it's gonna happen.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
God. Okay, Jordan, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We here at The Damage Report, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, a candidate's gonna join us on the other side. If you are running for Congress, especially if you're running for the first time, it can certainly be helpful if the party gets behind you, but they don't always choose candidates the way you think they might. And possibly the highest thing on their list of priorities is someone who can generate a huge amount of money raised to run their candidacy with. Joining us now to break this down and issues surrounding it, Anita Malik, congressional candidate for Arizona's 6th District. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Hopefully our connection will work out a little bit better than it did last time. So look, I want to continue talking about an article you wrote, Money Can't Buy Me Votes. We were talking about what you've learned about, and people are seeing a shot of it right there, what you've learned from your previous run about what money can and can't actually do. For people who might not have seen our first time, could you just briefly summarize what you were getting at with your article?
Sure. You know, I really believe we need to get the money out of politics like so many people do. However, I think that we're looking at this as some big legislative thing that needs to happen, overturning Citizens United. And of course, that's all important. But we also need to look at what I learned in 2018, how are we spending money as campaigns and why is it costing so much? Why is the donor class truly so, so small in this country and we're eliminating the voices of other people? And I think it's because we've really bought into a notion of expensive, overpriced consultants coming out of DC, TV ads, which research proves don't work. And that combination has really come down to a point where we're spending this money and making it a race about money and a race to raise rather than really the voice of the people in these different districts and different areas.
So one thing that's always frustrated me about this is not just that the party wants candidates who are gonna raise a ton of money, but they also want candidates who are going to spend that money in very particular ways, some of which you just listed, right, including hiring on these campaign consultants and buying expensive TV ads. And of course, we know that many of the people who are pushing for this inside of the Democratic Party are not entirely disconnected from these people who are then going to profit off these candidates. And again, they'll profit whether the candidate wins or loses. So like going forward, is that a sustainable system? This sort of like it's, if not legally corrupt, it's certainly inherently corrupt and not ideal in terms of producing the best electoral outcomes.
Right. And I think it's also a symptom of this divisiveness, or actually one of the reasons we have this divisiveness in our country. And we're continuing, if we continue to make money the focus, we're only perpetuating that. Because again, it's those few, those people that are profiting off these campaigns, those people that are able to donate, that are setting the agenda in DC. That class is really setting the tone and creating that continued divide, I believe, because then both sides will just continue to put money at the problem, leaving out the average American, the average voter that can't put in, max out to a campaign, that doesn't have that say because it's come down to money. So it's not sustainable. It's not good for our democracy. It's something extremely hard to fight if you want to kind of model what I'm trying to do, which is publicly funded elections. But if you're going to get in, I believe you need to get in the right way so that you can then go to DC and legislate for those things without having that burden of being beholden to anybody.
So you mentioned there how hard it is to fight for this, but I'm curious in what forms that difficulty is manifesting. Is it difficult because people are suspicious about public financing? They have a lack of understanding of how it would actually look? Or is there a significant pushback from the many different people who are benefiting from the way the system has been run?
It's definitely not suspicion on the part of voters and people here on the ground. We've found with independent voters in particular, they understand. Not everyone knows the rules and the regulations with campaign finance, but they know that the money is the issue. It's why we are here as we are in this country today, is because of the money in politics. So we have found this to actually be something that people are embracing, but the pushback, what makes it hard, is from the people in DC that have decided that you need to raise money, otherwise we're gonna try to shut you out as a candidate. And I've seen that now, this is my second cycle where I'm going through that in a much more aggressive form this time for sure, but definitely, we've been here before, we proved something in 2018 that money isn't only what it takes, it's about community building, it's about thinking outside the box and really reaching voters on the ground. But yet again, the establishment's decided to turn their backs on us.
And so you mentioned there that it's coming in a more aggressive form this race compared to last one. So tell me more about that.
So the DCCC has publicly come out, and I'd say we've known this for a while. It's kind of nice that they're admitting it finally, but it does hurt us. They've publicly come out and endorsed, put on the red to blue list, my primary opponent, who, truth be told, can't vote for herself, doesn't live in this district, is a great candidate, would do much better than the Republican incumbent, but at the end of the day came into this district as a effort of the establishment to bring someone in to what is now a targeted district because of the work that we did last cycle that can raise the money. Because again, for them, it's about the money and saying, we're gonna target it. Why not help Anita, the former nominee? No, let's bring someone else in that will play along with the money game.
Yeah, so it's gotta lead to some mixed feelings. They obviously appreciate in some form the work that you did, but not in a way that actually benefits you. So I can see how that would be frustrating.
Right. Yes, for sure. And you know, it's not about me. It's really about the movement of people. And we had an incredible volunteer grassroots movement here in a district that no one really paid attention to in 2018 or previously. And so it was about the people. And the people have said, look, this is what we don't want to start over building name ID with a new candidate. We don't want to, you know, we did this together. And it's really insulting actually to the voters of the district.
You know, just brief, and I apologize if this comes out of nowhere, but as you're talking to people about the way that people have to raise money, how much money they need. The elections are getting more and more expensive. We're in a context right now where Mike Bloomberg has apparently already spent like $500 million and is likely to spend even more. Is that a thing that people are talking about what that might represent as like the perfect crystallization of how much money is going to these elections right now?
Right, it's definitely on people's minds on both sides, right? We see that there are people that see this as, we hear it's the electability factor, we've got to do anything we can against Trump. And then there's the people that say, we're just perpetuating the problem. And I think at the presidential level, that's where people are torn. It's the Trump factor here.
Yeah.
And we're definitely hearing that. And, you know, but what is terrifying to candidate like me and to people, I think, all the way down the ballot is, what is that precedent setting that we can buy our way into elections? Because again, we're perpetuating the problem. We continue to do this, we'll continue to be in that situation.
Yeah. And Anita, where can people find out more about your candidacy?
AnitaForArizona.com.
Okay, and thank you as always for joining us. Hopefully we can check in a little bit further on in your race.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break, one more segment after this. Seeing there is Bernie and Jane Sanders, and they're walking into I think is it the Tacoma Arena?
Tacoma Dome.
And it's in Washington. There's apparently 17,000 people there. Now, Bernie has had a lot of rallies over the past year, and he's been able to draw large crowds. Despite that, 17,000 is a lot of people, particularly in a state that's like that's not the next state. It's not the second next state. It's further down the line, but 17,000 people were there. And I saw a tweet from Cancel Sam on Twitter who embedded a bit from that debate. And I really agreed with Cancel Sam's take. So I want to show you this bit of the video, and then I want to explain why this matters so much. Look, I don't want to get like schmoopy or whatever, but Cancel Sam had a caption to that video that I could not agree more with, which was that we can't read his mind, but it kind of doesn't it feel like in what you just saw, him looking at that massive crowd, like doesn't it feel like he's thinking, we might do this? Like this might actually happen, and not just because of the crowd. The crowd is amazing, 17,000 people. Any other candidate would love to have that. Mike Bloomberg could pay for 17,000 people. He could pay $1 million each, he wouldn't even care. But nobody else is getting crowds like that. But it's that, and amidst, you know, he obviously got the most votes in Iowa. He won in New Hampshire. He's built a double digit national lead in the most recent polls, multiple polls with him up big. He's forecasted to potentially win both Nevada and South Carolina. He's currently forecasted to win California and Texas, so the next two states, and also the biggest two states. He's broken all manner of records in terms of his fundraising, $25 million just in January, as he's being attacked constantly. And when I think about him surrounded by those 17,000 people with all of this good news over the past few weeks, And like, and it's a good crowd of good people. These are not MAGA heads. Like, these are just wonderful people who want people to have access to healthcare, and they want them to be able to go to college without being crushed by student loan debt for the rest of their lives. Like, they want them to potentially be able to own a home and be left alone and all that stuff. Like, he has been fighting for getting on towards half a century, and now he's surrounded by those people, and it feels like it might actually happen. And so when he smiles in that video, it feels like I think he thinks it can actually happen in a way that was never as clear in 2016. And look, I know there's a danger in getting complacent or getting ahead of yourself. I don't want to do that for myself, and I certainly don't want to lead you to ever feel like that. But we can pause for just a second or two to appreciate how far he's come, how far we've come with him, how far the country has come, in no small part thanks to his efforts and the efforts of the movement that he has inspired, the candidates that have run only because of the example that he set in 2016. And things are looking pretty good right now. We'll see. You never know what's gonna happen, and maybe a billionaire will come along and spend $10 billion to win this thing. But as of right now, it feels good. It feels good. Okay, everybody, thank you for joining me throughout this episode. I'm gonna be on the main show with Anna Kasparian for both hours later today. And of course, look forward to the debate coverage tomorrow, the first appearance of the Bloomberg. Should be pretty exciting. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.